We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
You are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Mark. I am on with my co-host, Kim. How are you, Kim?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
Excellent. I'm ready for another series of amazing stories that have come our way all the way back from 1993. This originally aired October 13th, 1993, allegedly. It's also an Unsolved Mystery. This is Season 6, Episode 4 of Unsolved Mysteries that we're discussing today. But to just kind of jump right into it, I love how some of these stories just seem so common at first, and then they just kind of blow up. And I find that very often it's the simple ones that really get complicated at the end, or they leave you kind of wanting more. And I think maybe that's what this podcast provides for people.
I hope so.
You know, it's kind of like, for instance, we didn't get a photograph at the end of one of these.
But I found one.
But you found one. And I just remember thinking, like, I know you're going to find one. I have a lot of faith in your research and your deep dives and your, I don't think you would give up. You'd probably sketch one if you needed to. evidence.
No, we won't. But if you guys want to see the picture and you'll know what we're talking about, head on over to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast on Facebook. That's our Facebook page, and we post all the episode resources there.
Yeah, and come on down, talk to us and everything. If you like this podcast, please leave us 5 stars, nothing less. We're not worth anything less than that. We're worth less. No, but please leave us 5 stars. Anywhere you can, iTunes or wherever, you can just leave a review or just share it with somebody who might enjoy listening to true crime or Unsolved Mysteries throwbacks.
That'd be awesome.
So this begins in 1974 in February. The crime actually does take place in February of 74. But
yes,
Zell Lossoff, who's this woman who, she seems like a nice enough woman. I don't know. I think she has some secrets to tell. She gets a late night.
She's so cute.
She is, but I almost don't trust her.
Oh.
I trust no one these days. I'm giving everybody the a little bit of the gentleman stare. I'm just like,
okay.
What are you all about? Because there's money to be made under this story. So Zell gets a late night visit from her daughter and son-in-law. They're told that her son, Ted Lossoff, died. And they're thinking he committed suicide. And it doesn't seem to be one of these type of situations where he had any issues. He was a pretty successful person. Do we know what his career was?
He's a doctor. He's a surgeon.
Yeah. And I couldn't find too much about if he was like a surgeon to the stars or anything like that, but
I don't know,
but definitely a surgeon. He seemed to make a pretty good living and he seemed to have acquired a great deal of wealth, but he committed suicide.
Right. Which, you know, I mean, it happens. It definitely happens. Zell says, you know, he's not the kind of guy who would have committed suicide. And while I believe her in this case, like, everybody says that about their loved one. It's just a hard pill for people to swallow. So she says she thinks he was actually murdered.
Yeah. And there does seem to be evidence to kind of apply towards that. So So again, Ted was a well-respected surgeon, and he had married a woman named Wilda. Mm-hmm. And Wilda was a bit of a complicated person. At least that was the depiction. She would drink a lot, and she seemed to be going on these tirades. And you have a comment here that maybe there was infidelity as well.
Yeah, I've heard that she was quite unfaithful. I got a lot of this information from a 1985 LA Times article called A Mother's Obsession, Justice for Son, by Lori Beckland. And it says that, yeah, she was kind of known to get around. She was an alcoholic. And this whole episode just made me want a cigarette and a house dress and a nice martini or something. And I don't even drink or smoke. But
with lounge music on in the background, of course.
Exactly. Yeah, nonetheless. So she was like a character. And they were actually only married for 27 months when Ted died.
Mm. Now, on the evening of... I don't know if it was the evening, but I think when they're showing the video of it, it might be the evening. But she called the police on February 23rd, 1974, and said that Ted has a gun.
Mm-hmm.
There's also claims of suicide attempts by Ted. And I'm just kind of... There's no evidence of that, though. That's really just her word, right?
Well, from the article that I read, it's pretty much presented as fact. Like, I think even Zelda says, yeah, in 1972, he tried to commit suicide.
Well, we do. Later on, there's a note that we talk about, and somebody did say that that note is from 2 years ago. So that's where things get a little bit weird, too.
Here's what the note says. The note says, Wilda, all I ever asked for was one moment's compassion and understanding. I love you, T.
So dramatic. But
it is dramatic, but to me, that's not even necessarily a suicide note. That could be a note that he just wrote and stormed off and went to go sleep in a hotel for the night. Like, that doesn't say, and I'm ending at all. Like, right. To me, that was not definitively final.
That could be a lyric. I mean, you could look at a ton of my writings and everything and probably think, like, something's wrong with this guy. And maybe there is. Maybe there is something wrong with me. But I'm not going to commit suicide. If somebody's listening to this and I commit suicide, I didn't commit suicide. I was murdered.
I will avenge you.
I said this to my wife. Every time I see suicide, anything, I said, you know, I just want to let you know that if I commit suicide, I was murdered. Because I don't have the, I know this is a very serious topic. I don't think I have it within me to electively make this choice. You know, it's thank goodness I've never been so low to feel that way. And I really, really pity the people who are at that point and they feel like there's no other choice.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, hopefully I'm not being too light about it. It's just, I don't think it's in me to, maybe I'm too narcissistic, but
that's what I was thinking.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. That's typical.
No.
It's typical just, coming from you.
It's just in certain people or not in certain people, you know? I mean, we talked about it a little bit with our last episode where the guy had a quote-unquote suicide attempt, and it was like, there is no way this guy would do it. And I could see that in you. I'm not calling you a narcissist.
I know, I'm kidding. I'm not calling you a narcissist.
Have narcissistic tendencies.
Yes. I think we're all a little narcissistic.
Oh, yeah. I'm totally narcissistic.
I think, you know what? I read it somewhere that if you think that you are not narcissistic, you are narcissistic.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. It's another one of these like sellout type of comments. But it's, but all in all, if you're listening to this and you think that things are not going to get any better or anything like that, please get help. You know, please, look up suicide hotline and definitely, I mean, because there's always like tomorrow and all that. Not to sound like all Tony Robbins here, but I don't think that there's anyone who regrets not committing suicide.
Yeah, no, for sure. I hear you. Yeah, we want you to stick around.
Yeah. Plus, you have to leave us a like and all that stuff. You have to leave us 5 stars. So, here's the thing. Leave us 5 stars and then reach out to the hotline.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not going to say don't do that.
Sure. well, as far as...
Help me, Kim.
Yeah, I've got you. I'll throw you a life preserver. So we're back in 1974.
Thank God.
And Wilda is with family friend Edward J. and their housekeeper. Now, we are going to call her housekeeper Mary to respect her privacy, just like Unsolved Mysteries.
One of my favorite actresses so far in Unsolved Mysteries.
She was amazing. Honestly, both the women I thought killed it in this scene. I thought the like fabulous drunk crazy one
no
was
pun
like
intended.
Really giving it her all. No, yeah, exactly. So they go into the police. They go in the house with the police, and there is no Ted there. And they end up finding him slumped over his car in his car in the garage with the engine running and the hose in the tailpipe. Yeah. So in the reenactment, they just like pick him up and sprawl him out in the driveway, which seemed really tacky. They're like practically stepping over him.
Right. You don't have a tarp or something, anything, and put a coat over him.
Yeah, it was really weird. But, you know, this is the reenactment. I don't know how much of the reenactment is, like, what actually happened. So, Wilda, the wife, is kind of avoiding Zell, who's Ted's mom. And Zell says that she wants a watch back that she had given Ted for their wedding. So, in the reenactment, they're, like, at this beautiful lunch, and she just, like, takes the watch and throws it at his mom and just says, "Listen, Zell, I didn't care about Ted the way you did. I'm glad he's gone." And, again, like, who knows if there's any truth to that? It was so dramatic.
Right, right. You can almost hear the music in the background as that happens.
Yeah, it was very Dynasty. Like, I figured yeah. They'd just start slapping each other and throw wine in the face. And, you know, and I mean, the mom is trying so hard to prove to us, the police department, everybody, that this was a murder. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, she's going to say Wilda had some pithy comment to make about how much she hated him. So,
can I also mention something? Yeah. Now, we're both married, not to each other, but we're both married individually. And does it seem a little bit weird that he would be gifted an individual gift?
Yeah, I guess that is kind of weird.
Now, what if, this is hypothetical, what if that was the wedding gift? A watch for Ted.
That's kind of messed up.
Maybe she paid for the wedding, and here's... You know, I'm so happy you guys are together. Here, Ted. You know, I don't know. I'm just kind of thinking, you know, they do have this really nice relationship on paper. And I'm just wondering out loud. And if that's the case, I can understand being kind of upset about something like that.
Well, maybe it was like his and hers watches. But because Wilda's still alive, she's not going to take Wilda's back.
But, well, all right. I mean, if it was his and her watch, why would you want to separate the pair? I mean, it's... But you're right. It's also kind of creepy to say I want it back. I mean, if it's a family heirloom, that's a whole other situation. Yeah, but they didn't mention it. Maybe it's just maybe it wasn't even a watch. Maybe it was one of those things where it's like you're lying. It wasn't even a watch. It was, you know, a blender. And it's just kind of one of those strange things that I kind of stuck in my head, kind of wondering, well, why do you want it back? Is kind of strange. Or it could be an excuse, because this is another thing that happens, I think, with families. When somebody passes away, you need an excuse to see them, especially when you're not married, when they're married into the family. So maybe this was just her reaching out and saying that, but I don't know. I just thought it was kind of a weird thing to request.
Well, speaking of stuff that's kind of weird, Zell one night, I loved this. I thought this was very cool. Zell one night is snoozing away and she has a dream where she's like in Ted's garage and she walks around and she doesn't know where she is at first, but then she's like, oh wait, this is Ted's garage. I know, because there's so much like boating stuff, miscellany, you know, just all the junk that piles up in people's garages. And so she was like, wait a second. There's also two super heavy iron gates that never worked. So she kind of recalls through this dream that the garage was full and that it would have been impossible for him to park back there because of the iron gates. So he actually usually parked on the street. And she was like, to get his car in the garage, he would have had to have moved all the boat stuff out of there. And he just had back surgery. So he wasn't really lifting anything too heavy. I thought that was really cool.
Does this happen to you personally all the time? You wake up in the middle of the night? Because I feel like you have a very analytical mind, which is why I think that the research that is 99% done by you is the phenomenal research. Let me just add that.
Oh.
The you do tend to connect the dots and everything. And I would just imagine that you kind of, I don't know, maybe you're doing the dishes one day and you're like, and it's like, wait a minute. And I think it is really cool. I think I've never personally had a dream where I connected the dots, woke up and had this revelation. But we've all heard of it. And I'm just kind of, I could picture this happening to you, 4 a.m. Wait a minute.
Interesting. Well, no, it's really weird that you said that, because I'll talk about this more on our next episode. Stay tuned next week. But I did recently, like, recall a reoccurring nightmare that I had from childhood that thought might be, like, a past life regression thing. And I got really excited about it. So that, I kind of connected the dots. In my adulthood, my dreams are so mundane that, I mean, they could be real life. Like, I'll go grocery shopping and I'll run into my neighbor. But that never happened, you know? So I don't really have too, like, deep of dreams.
Okay. Well, that you know of. So.
Well, that I know of, exactly. And I don't really remember too many of my dreams, but thank you for all the nice things you said.
No, you're welcome. Thank you. And, you know, by the way, on The Odd, my other podcast, I have interviewed a number of people who do dream analysis and these type of things. Now, you know, they do lean towards a little bit of hypnosis, which, of course, we both...
It could be tricky.
Yeah, I almost said we both roll our eyes at, but I'm not going to say we both roll our eyes at it. It's not fully understood, and it's easy to manipulate. So
exactly.
All right. So Zell is, you know, she is like Sherlock Holmes. You know, she's taking into her own hands that she's going to figure out what exactly happened to Ted. And she meets up with Mary.
Mm-hmm. The housekeeper.
And Mary seems to be somebody who's very, very involved in Ted's life.
Mary is so cool, too. Like, she's a little bit of, like, just a cool customer. I really liked her. And like you said, the reenactment was phenomenal.
No, there seems to be, at least in the reenactment, there seems to be this, like, really, really, she's like a live-in housekeeper. So maybe when you have a live-in, it's, you have this kind of almost kinship, but not really. It just seemed kind of interesting that she would know so much and be so involved and be there for all of this. You know, it just seems so crazy. And then you bring in Wilda, who's kind of like the wild, you know, there's a reason why wild is in her name. And, you know, Mary is also dealing with Wilda.
Yeah, no, I think that when you have like help, quote unquote, the help, you're just a fly on the wall and you see all the crazy stuff that happened. I know when I was a caterer, I was pretty much like invisible to people, but I got all the dirt because you're just you're omnipresent, you know. So, and plus, if you're like the housekeeper, you're like washing their underwear and stuff like that. Like, you're pretty in their business. Yeah. So,
or vomit off of a bedspread, as we will see in the future. Maybe.
Exactly. Maybe it's vomit. Exactly. So one day, everybody's just minding their own business. Ted tells Mary out of nowhere that that him and Wilda are going to get a divorce. So Wilda comes storming in and she causes this huge scene and acts like Ted is threatening her with a gun. So Mary's like, I don't really like all this, so I'm just going to go home. And so she sees Wilda walking down the street and Wilda's like, oh, Mary, what am I going to do? And she's chain smoking and Mary's
constantly.
Like,
this is one of these weird things, though. It's kind of like she's always smoking. I don't really understand why they kept doing that. Maybe was it to bring her nervousness to the table?
And it was the 70s, and I'm not. She was fabulous. Like, I'm sorry. There's like a certain kind of cold woman that's drunk and chain smokes that I'm just drawn to. It's the Liza Minnelli love I have. So, she's like, look, crazy lady, hop in the car. We'll go to my house and we'll call the police. So Mary calls the police on behalf of Wilda, but Wilda won't get on the phone and say directly that Ted threatened her. So the police are like, well, that's a cool story, but there's absolutely nothing we can do.
Right.
So Mary's like, I'm going to call Ted. So she tries to call Ted 20 times between 3 p.m. and 8 p.m.
This is 5 hours of your employer hanging out in your house.
Yeah, getting drunk, like, the whole time she was just drinking that whole bottle.
But she's getting double drunk, probably. It's kind of like she probably showed up while she was sobering up, and then she's going to get double drunk.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't doubt that one bit at all.
Double
so,
drunk. Is that a thing?
The line was always going to be busy until 8 o'clock. So finally, at 8 o'clock, it started ringing, but there's no answer. So Mary called the police, and... So they show up, and she thought it was kind of odd that the suicide note that we mentioned earlier was on shirt cardboard, because she always ironed his shirts and put them on hangers. but it could have been a new shirt. Like, you know how shirts come with that stiff cardboard? Yeah,
that's the thing is new ones come in the cardboard, right? No, I'm not. Exactly. I don't know about fancy shirts. Do shit. I don't know. If you were to get like an Armani shirt, does it come in a cardboard? I personally don't own an Armani colored shirt.
Me neither, but yeah, I would say probably so,
with all the stupid pins and everything, right?
Exactly. Those pins. Yeah, exactly.
Who puts those pins in?
I don't know, but one time my dad thought he got bitten by like a Black Widow spider because his arm was all swollen and like bleeding and infected. And it turns out that he just forgot to take the pin out of his new shirt and it just kept poking him in the same spot, but it was like really bruised.
It's a pin!
Yeah.
Oh my exactly. God, those pins. All right, I'm sorry.
So Mary noticed that earlier in the day when she was there, he was wearing brown pants and a mustard-colored shirt, but like when Dwight his body Schrute. Was... When his body was found, he was actually wearing gray pants and a dress shirt. But, you know, he could have changed his clothes. But also, that outfit was never seen again. So that's a little suspicious.
So which outfit? The mustard shirt and brown pants were never seen again? Yeah. Now, they also said that the outfit that they found him in is not an outfit that he would normally have worn.
Yeah, I got that too. But, I mean, it looked fine.
Yeah, like... And I do, one of the theories is that, I guess we'll get to the theory and we'll bring up the, you know, men undressing and redressing right. a dead person. Like, it just, to me, that seems like a lot of work.
Oh my God, that's not even the half of the work.
No, it is a ton of work. You know, honestly, yeah. I have to clean out my garage. These guys, I want to hire these guys because, you know, it's the amount of work that has to be done. I couldn't imagine how much they, if hypothetically it's all true, how much they would have to be paid to do all of this.
Oh my gosh, I know. But I don't think money was an object here.
It's true. It's true.
Now, keep in mind, Wilda and Ted signed a prenuptial agreement, which means that if they got divorced, which he was planning on doing, that Wilda would get nothing. So when Mary goes into the house afterwards, after the body's sprawled out in the driveway, she finds several empty beer cans and four glasses and like lots of cigarettes. And he never drank. He didn't smoke cigarettes. And the brand that was found, interesting to note, is actually a favorite of one of Wilda's friends. So a week later, Mary's just doing her housekeeper thing and she finds some unusual stains on the bedspreads. And she said, it looks like vomit.
And so here's the thing. A week later, he's dead. And yeah. she is yet to change the bedspread. I mean, it could be a week later. Finally, you know, today I came back to work. Could be.
But it was in the guest room, and it's not like he died in the bed. So, I mean, as far as she knows, so I could see it happening.
Yeah, I guess it's definitely possible to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's like, it looks like vomit. Wilda's like, oh yeah. One of our dogs threw up on the bedspread. But Mary said that the dogs were in the kennel that night. So after washing the sheets, the vomit spots completely disintegrated, which I mean, she washed them.
Probably in bleach.
Like, you know, yeah.
That'll exactly. make it really disintegrate.
Yeah. I think they made too big of a deal about how it disintegrated, but passersby had noted movement inside the house, long after the time that forensics experts concluded that Ted had died. And Mary said that she had seen a large stack of cash upstairs that was gone later that night. So because Mary is so cool, she actually used to be a nurse. And she said in this LA Times article, that man didn't commit suicide. And I said so that night. Someone did it for him. She had worked for 17 years at a hospital and she had cleaned up after patients who died. And she was like, his bowels should have evacuated after he died and he should have urinated on himself, which was common after death. And she said that his coloration had seemed very different from other carbon monoxide victims that she had seen.
And that's the telltale sign. I mean, I guess most bodies will release any type of pressure, you know, to be as blunt as possible. And But yeah, it's really the color of the corpse that will determine. I mean, sometimes they'll turn yellow or depending on, you know, how they're killed. But I don't know what color carbon monoxide victims turn.
I don't either.
But I think it's a telltale sign, though.
Yeah, and she seems to know her stuff. I mean, she worked at a hospital for 17 years, so I'll trust her. And she says that she told the cops that night, but because she's just a domestic worker, that police weren't taking it seriously. So This is just all the inspiration Zell needs. Zell already kind of thought something was up. So in 1978, she won a legal battle to have his body exhumed. And she hired forensic pathologist Dr. Irving Root to examine his body. And he said that Ted, shortly before his death, suffered a violent vomiting spell.
Yeah.
I know that there was vomitus in his, like, bronchial tubes and, like, in his esophagus and stuff like that. My question, but there was no vomit in the car.
What I find so weird about this is, it seems like some cases it's so difficult to get a body exhumed. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying this wasn't a difficult thing, but there has to be some reason to dig up a corpse, you know?
Yeah.
There has to be a legal reason. And I'm wondering, is it because of the questionable death and new evidence had come to light?
Yes. And she was super upset that when they did the autopsy, they were supposed to have taken 2 teaspoons worth of blood to test for any poisons or anything like that in his body.
Yeah, toxic.
And they skipped that step. So I think that was a big step in that decision to exhume the body.
Oh, okay. I mean, if it's something that the coroner overlooked, I can fully understand. All right, you want to exhume it, then we'll definitely do it. Type of thing.
Yeah, but it still took 4 years.
And I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you know about this, and it's one of those kind of weird questions, but okay, when a body dies, we mm-hmm. pump it up with chemicals, you know, formaldehyde, right. I think is still used,
mm-hmm.
and that preserves the body on some level. But I'm wondering at what point is the preservation no longer, I guess, relevant? You know, they can still do an autopsy 4 years later. This is 4 seasons. I mean, granted, 6 feet mm-hmm. under, but, you know, 4 winters, 4 summers. It's, mm-hmm. you know, God knows what came into the coffin. At what point, I wonder, and I am just kind of talking out, you know, just wondering out loud, at what point do we draw the line and say, well, we can't really determine this because of the amount of decay?
I don't know. I mean, there's new science all the time that they can test things. But it seems like with this one, the main thing was getting blood. And if he's embalmed, then we're not really going to have any blood left. So I don't know. And I'd love to know the answer to your question. And I will.
Yeah, we're both going to be Googling it. And I do want to mention that Kim and I Google for you some of the scariest things that have put us both more likely on more FBI lists than we care to be on.
Honestly, no, seriously, like, how long does it take for a body to break down in a furnace? You know, right. Like that kind of information.
Oh my God, a future episode. Oh my God, that's...
Well, not at this time. Not at this time. It'll be like 2 weeks ago.
Oh yeah, but no, but we...
Oh yeah, yeah,
there's
a
future one. I was just like, my mind was blown on this one.
Oh yeah, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
That's a little hint for the future. So...
There you go.
But you know... Yeah, like just today I was Googling, how long does it take to fill a garage up with carbon monoxide before you are, you know, affected by it? And this is something I've said. By the way, I'm never going to do this again after reading about it. Because I work on engines all the time in my garage. Never again will I do this. I will, mm-hmm. even with the garage door open, people have died.
And crazy.
From now on, I will pull the car into my driveway and we will do it there.
See, we're already saving lives on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind.
You know, it's really a service that we provide for my own personal life. But I do want to say that sometimes we do some of these scary searches and we are reporting the best that we can.
Yeah, absolutely. We're trying our hardest. We're not reporters, but we try. So... Zell's theory, basically, that she kind of has come up with is that Wilda had hired people to beat up and kill Ted, and that she thinks that he had been overpowered by at least 2 men who forced poison down his throat.
Oh, my God. That reenactment was very dramatic. That was the way I pictured in my head if it was really happening. Very scary.
Yeah, it was. And they took the phone off the hook. They forced poison down his throat. He's throwing up. They cleaned him up, dressed him in new clothes. Emptied out the entire garage.
Yeah, where did they put everything?
That is a great question. They never covered that. Great question. Yeah. But
a big picture a big messy garage that you cannot fit your car into.
Yeah, one that you walk around to try and find something, and you're like, you know what? Maybe I'll just buy a new one. There's no way I'm finding it.
Just burn the garage down.
Exactly. So they had to then force the gates open, push the car into the garage, moved his body car, closed the garage, locked the door from the inside, closed the gates, went back in the house, put the phone on the hook as a sign to Wilda that the job was done. So in March of 1982, 8 years after his death, the coroner finally ordered an inquest into this death. And it's really interesting because Edward J., a witness who knew the family, had testified that the suicide note was written by Ted, but it was written 2 years earlier.
Yeah.
He also testified that after he was discovered, after the body was discovered, Wilda came running down the stairs with Ted's glasses and asked Edward to put them on Ted's face.
So strange.
Yeah, and she remarried the next year on May 1st, 1983. Wilda OD'd on drugs and alcohol, and she died. And 2 years after that, his cause of death was officially changed to undetermined. But there's not really anything we can do because the main suspect is dead now, being Wilda. So Zell died in 2010 at the age of 101 years old.
Oh, my God. God bless her.
I know. I felt so bad for her. She's at the end of the
episode. I take back everything I said.
I love her. She's like, oh, maybe one day I'll be able to sing again. That's all I really want. And hoping to find closure. And sadly, no, nothing really happened. She died. Everybody in that family's dead. From what I could tell, Ted's sister's dead. Ted's obviously passed away. So just very, very sad story.
And we'll put a link to their Find the Graves.
Yeah.
Do you want to do that? I mean, should we do that? I don't know. Is that a violation? I don't think so.
Oh, I don't think so.
I think it's a nice way to memorialize some of these people. And I don't know. It's a great website as well. So it's very interesting to find out if you have famous people buried around you and all that kind of good stuff, too.
Totally. So shall we dive into Wally's Hidden River?
Dive into the river, which I think is a stream. This is a weird one. This is something I think we both will agree that you cannot take things to the grave. All right.
Yeah.
In 1927, actually, you start this one. You're so much better. Okay. I love listening to you tell the story. I'm so sorry. All right.
Oh, no, please. I'm happy to. So 1927, prospector Earl Dorr drove into the desert because of an old Indian legend that said that there's a river hidden under the desert. It's full of gold. And we're talking like the Nevada desert.
Yeah.
So according to a signed affidavit, Dorr and his sidekick found the entrance to the cavern, which led to the river, which was 3,500 feet under the desert. The river was 8 miles long. The men explored it for 4 days and found a ton of gold. So Ralph Lewis, who's a local historian slash miner, says that Dorr probably found an underground sluice where water comes through and it has enough force to kind of whisk away the lighter rocks and sediment and stuff, but it keeps the heavier minerals, which stay like gold.
Well, I do want to just mention, I think you and I both mentioned that we've both been suckered into doing one of these more comedic panning of gold.
Yeah.
And what it is when you do that, it becomes a slurry, you know, and that's where kind of sluice comes from. I never heard of the word sluice, but I think that's where the slurry comes from.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it becomes like a muddy slurry and you pan, but I think that the slurry has so much gold within it because, you know, if we're talking about an area that is for millions of years just untouched by really anything, by wildlife, by anything, all of this stuff would just kind of have the time to settle because gold, I believe, would just slowly and slowly settle. So the slurry or the sluice, like you could just scoop up this mud or this dirt right below the water's surface. And I mean, right at the under, you know, on the bottom, the water floor. And mm-hmm. It would have so much gold within it because it had millions of years to settle. It's crazy.
And the only thing I disagree with, I totally agree with you. I just think a sluice, because I looked it up and I saw man-made sluices, and it is like where they will hollow out a place to mine.
Oh, really? All right. I've never, like I said, I've never heard the word.
No, me neither. Me neither. And that was just my very rudimentary understanding of it, is that the river itself was the sluice, was like an underground mining sluice. But I do think that the gold settled and that everything else kind of got washed away. But it was so much gold that they estimated the whole river, which was 8 miles, has 100 ounces of gold per cubic yard of river.
Whatever that means. I mean, but
yeah, don't ask me to explain.
I looked it up and I was like, I couldn't find the measurement. It seems like a lot.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's fair to say.
A lot. That's our equation. It's a lot.
So Dor was like, okay, cool deal. I'll just take all this gold, if that's cool with you, to the landowner. And the landowner's like, no, this is my land. You're not going to get away with that. So he's like, fine. So he dynamites the entrance closed of the river. Because he's like, guess what? There's probably another entrance along this whole 8 miles. Right. But
it's the silliest thing of all time. I'm going to dynamite it. I mean, he also didn't tell the landowner that he found this, right?
No, he told the landowner, and the landowner's like, get off my property. So he's like, fine, I'll just blow up something on your property so you can't get the gold either, now, which is crazy.
I think finding another way in was probably a pretty common thing, right? You would buy the property next to it. I think the movie about about oil and everything kind of references this. You know, it came out just a few years ago, super violent movie about this oil guy and the whole milkshake.
I drink your milkshake.
Well, that's essentially it.
Oil, something like that.
You know, if you think about it, he put the straw in another location and took out all the oil.
Oh, okay.
And that's what that's a reference to. And I think that this was a pretty common sneaky tactic. You just kind of go down the road. The oil's over there, too.
Yeah, exactly. There Will Be Blood.
Yes, thank you so much. Good movie.
Thank you, Google. So he was never able to find the entrance again either. And then we fast forward to the 1980s. Rocket ships are going up by NASA, and they're taking really good pictures that we've never had this good quality before. So they're shown to scientist Wally Spencer, actual name Robert Wallace Spencer. And he thinks that he found where the old river was. I was hoping you could explain this because I know you got it more than I did.
So you mean about why it's there?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of vegetation. There's a lot of animals at one period of time, let's just say 5, 10, 15 million years ago. And you know, it all lives there. And of course, oil is from dead bodies and rotted trees over millions of years, you know, after the breakdown. So just eventually over the period of time, we all just become fossilized and gross and we turn into oil. You know, it's just kind of what people do. And that's it, really. You had a living area and it died. Maybe a drought began over a period of time and everything just, the animals were to walk a little bit, they're not going to go too far. So they really congregate in this one area and eventually they die off and it all rots and turns to oil over a period of time.
Yeah. So he's looking for this oil and he makes like a DIY prospecting machine.
Yeah. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, he would go out with his like Bronco and they would just slowly go, you know, foot by foot over the desert and try and find this patch beneath them.
Now you were talking about you learning how to use a device like this, weren't you?
Can't say that was me.
I could have sworn you said you were going to be using some type of sonar device in the future. Seriously. I'm not making this up.
No. All right. I don't know who that was, but it was your man.
All right. I'm going to find I'll find the when you said it. You're lying. No. Okay. No. All right. So it looks like a sonar device, which is kind of looking for caverns or something underground. I mean, I think it's just sending radio waves down. And if it... I think radio waves are dispersed on water, I think. And when they get to a dead spot, that means usually, you know, when the radio wave is diffusing, it's not bouncing back, it's hitting water.
Right. So he and his family put it to the test in June of 1989. For 3 weeks, they're going over this desert with a fine-tooth comb. And the machine does indicate that there's a reservoir of something. And he thought it was oil at first, but now he thinks it's the underground river that's all full of the gold. So they're like, in Nevada, this would be so amazing to have all this water so nearby. And he has to apply for a drilling permit, which would make the exact location of the river public record. And he's like, okay, I'll do that. I'll do what I got to do. But as long as you guys pay me a finder fee for the river. And the state's like, no, you go ahead and file your drilling as well as anybody else, because we don't even know that there's anything down here.
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit weird at this point. I don't think either one of us know how drilling permits work or who has claim. I mean, I would think whoever owns the property.
Yeah.
Would, exactly. You know, it's, you want to drill there. Resource. You drill there out of curiosity, but really whoever owns it, the property, would own it, I would think.
I would think so too. But Wally's like, nope, it's all mine. And I'm not going to file the drilling permit because I don't want you guys to know where it is and then go drill and find out that it is there. And so the state is trying to screw me out of all this money. Yeah. And
it's there or it's not there, no matter what. You know, it's like at the end of the day, it's either there or it's not there. And you can either, I would just imagine that they would have some type of deal where it's like, look, if you put out the money to do this, we'll give you 1% or cover all of your costs if you find something.
I think this was so crazy because he didn't even prove at all anything that there was any water there. So why would they put that forward? And they talked to a couple people from the Nevada like Water Bureau who are like, this guy's cuckoo crazy, basically, in so many words.
Yeah, they were comparing what he was doing to the rods,
To like a divining rod.
Yeah, which can be accurate, but at the same time, it's a very unexplained phenomenon, you know, which is kind of perfect, but it's really, there is no real evidence of what he was talking about.
And then we're going to dial the craziness up just another notch because Wally and his wife, for some reason, hire like investigators to see if his house is bugged because they think the government must be listening so that they can get the location of this oil. So the people come, or the water. So the people
come. I love these guys.
They were awesome. The guy was like snapping at him, hey, come over here. But
they
find out. Yeah, exactly. They find out that his house phone was bugged and they find a listening device behind a painting in his room.
Those guys are scamming him like there's no tomorrow. Those guys put that in there.
This is so preposterous. Like, they think that the government snuck into their house and put these listening devices in. That is crazy, Pam.
Now, here's the thing. Is Beverly even admitted to not... I mean, I think she admitted to not even knowing where this is, right?
No, she said we don't talk about it.
But she also didn't ever find anything.
Well, the last we know, because we're kind of left with an update, that she has filed 16 water rights applications, which are still pending.
Yeah, I even found crap about that. And I would think, this is almost 20 years later.
Just a little side note. She wasn't even his wife.
Right.
His obituary. Yes. She's actually his side piece because he's actually married to somebody else. But they only refer to her as his wife in the Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, I mean,
which makes me wonder how much claim she would even have to this anyway if she's not even married to him. So I don't know. It's all so ethically sketchy. I don't think anybody was like scamming them or listening to them. But we'll never know because he died in 2003 and that's it.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange thing. But it really does mean, like, you know, hypothetically, if he had found this, he probably could have become a very wealthy person from it. He could have found a way to become wealthy from it. But his greed really got in the way. And you brought up, you think that's kind of shady and maybe unethical to hold back natural resources.
I absolutely think so. In the desert where this water's coming and he's hogging this natural resource, which he did not put there, you know, and it wasn't even his property. And he's hogging a natural resource until he can cash out. I don't like that. I think that's immoral. I think it's unethical. I don't like it.
Yeah. And it was a kind of definitely a weird type of thing. And with the advent of more technologies that are like this, like ground penetrating radar and other things, and the way the entire Earth is now mapped from space, unless of course you believe flat Earth, but which we do not. And there's so much that we're learning, and you know, over the course of 20 years, that I would imagine that if this is on someone's radar, it's been looked into, and if something was there that had this much wealth associated to it, it would have been tapped into by now.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. So that brings us to LA.
Yeah, and this one I think we should probably just breeze through since it's an update from a previous segment.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk more about when we do that actual episode. But basically, it's a Saturday night in Los Angeles, late night, early in the morning. A few guys get together and they just motorcycle around town because the town's like dead at that time.
Yeah, it's like a Motley Crue video.
Yeah, it was awesome. And so there's this guy, popular DJ, 26-year-old Lee Selwyn, is part of the crew. And this Bronco, again, a Bronco, kind of cuts off the guys while they're biking. So they both come up to a red light and the guy's like, are you trying to hit me? Like, are you trying to kill me? What's going on? And the driver rolls down the window and spits in the motorcyclist's face.
Like total road rage type of like craziness going on here.
The most despicable thing you can do. And that's assault, by the way. That is like 100%
assault. That is, right? Now, I mean, I don't know if it was back then. I mean, it in my opinion, it's assault, but it's also legally an assault.
Yeah, exactly. And also, things are about to step up here. So it shows in the reenactment that the guy who almost got run over, the guy who got spit in the face, started kind of like beating up the Bronco, like the car itself. So the guy runs a red light, turns completely around, and starts trying to mow down these motorcyclists.
Can I just tell you one fun fact? I just need to.
Yeah.
Wendy Lou Lee, who plays Grace Ingalls on Little House on the Prairie, owned, mm-hmm. this was her first car, was a Ford Bronco. And I picture it being Grace Ingalls in this truck.
Because, do you guys know how hard it is for us to not bring up Little House every single episode? I swear, I actively try not to, but I hear you.
Yeah, this is what I picture. I picture this Grace Ingalls driving a Bronco and
little baby Grace.
And not to even make light of this, I think that this is something that happens in New York. Maybe not today, but it has happened relatively often where, you know, road rage turns really bad. You know, people have guns and throwing stuff at each other and smashing into each other. People need to just calm down when it comes to, you know, driving.
Exactly. And my personal read on the situation, because it was so late at night in Los Angeles, was he was probably a little drunk, swerved, almost accidentally hit the guy. But then, you know, it turns into like a pissing contest over who's the more manly one, you know, and then stuff just gets out of control. So the four motorcyclists actually scatter because the bad guy's like coming towards them in a car. And he just decides to take after Lee by luck of the draw. So Lee, who wasn't even part of the fight at all, gets chased over 30 city blocks. They said reaching speeds of 100 miles an hour. He eventually crashed and he was thrown 180 feet off of his motorcycle. So, of course, he suffered, like, a massive skull fracture and dies within hours at the hospital.
And this is a large SUV. This isn't, like, you know, this is a truck that probably weighs, like, 7,000 pounds after a motorcycle that weighs maybe 150. You know, it's just, it's manic. It really is.
The guy was gonna kill or hurt him, whatever happened. If he caught up with him, if he ran him over, if he chased him and he crashed, like nothing good was going to happen to poor Lee, who again was just minding his own business. Mm-hmm. He wasn't even in the fight. So an Unsolved Mysteries viewer caught the episode in a rerun and she said that there was a man named Franklin LeGrant Perkins who was in prison in Georgia at the time who always bragged about running down a bicycle.
How many times do we hear this? Where people talk about it, they need to boast about these things and they get busted for it.
Exactly. I saw a murder show of some kind or another that said, like, you're only going to get caught like a fish in the ocean. You only get caught if you open your mouth.
Yeah.
And it's like, God, they do just have to brag about it. I don't know if it's a guilty conscience or what. So the police actually get a picture of his mugshot and they show it to Lee's friends and they ID him from the photo lineup. So 5 days before he was supposed to get paroled in Georgia, he's arrested and they take him back to L.A. He, by the way, just if you're interested, he was serving a 5-year sentence for possession of a firearm by a felon when he was in Georgia. So, you know, we see Lee's mom and sister crying and just being like, thank God he's off the street.
And the mom seems very nice. Like, she's like, he was my buddy. He was, they were very close. And these are the little stories that always, you know, are very sad. But, you know, it's never like, eh, he was a bit of a shitty kid. You know?
I know.
It's, it seemed like they legitimately had a good relationship between them.
Yeah, and even the sister.
Yeah.
And so Franklin Perkins was convicted of first-degree murder, sentenced to life in prison. He is still in the Pelican Bay State Prison. I found the mom and sister on Facebook. They both live in Florida right now, and they're just doing the best they can. The sister actually became a grief therapist, so I don't know if that's because of this or what.
I'm sure definitely directed towards it on some level.
Yeah, so that is the sad story of Lisa Owen, but at least we end with a happy ending. At least the bad guy's in jail.
Over in England, so, 1952.
Ooh,
this is a weird story.
Yeah, please.
So in Plymouth, England, which I have no idea what part of England this is.
I don't either, but it's a port city.
Right. I mean, but this is 1952. This is a pretty dark period for England, I would say. You know, their economy is pretty trashed at this point. And all of Europe.
As well as, like, their buildings and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Nazis, you know, have been gone now for a little bit less than a decade. But still, you know, the remnants of war, you know, and that's real war. It's not like, you know, the United States, you know, where we didn't have on-ground attacks and stuff like that, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of refugees and there's a lot of just picking up the pieces. Now, they adopted Christopher, right?
Yeah, so we meet this young-ish couple called Helena and Apollinary Karowski.
Wow.
And they adopt Christopher as an infant.
Yeah, that's a name.
Oh, yeah, it was a mouthful. And so we learn that Helena's life is so sad. As you would expect, like a Polish refugee during World War II.
Yeah.
Her husband was actually executed by the Germans, and then she was forced to serve as a nurse in a German POW camp for 6 years.
I do want to point out that I have an inkling that she was not Jewish either. So, a lot of people, you know, they look at World War II in Europe and they're like, you know, the Jews were the only ones who were killed by the Nazis, but everybody was killed by the Nazis. You know, if you're in front of the Nazis, you have a good chance of just being killed no matter what.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
It was just one of those kind of, you know, crazy things that, they went through all of that and they somehow survived it, but she became a nurse for the POWs.
Mm-hmm. She was forced to.
Yeah. Well, yeah, she didn't become, I'm sorry. And if anything, I would say that she was probably lucky to become a nurse at a POW camp. And I was thinking about this, and it's something that I'm going to look into more and more and more, but the people who staffed the POW camps were probably also POWs. So
yeah,
it's just crazy the way the Germans, you know, while on paper it's clever, I guess, you know, but it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah, and it just is so bleak. Even the happy pictures that they show, everyone is so just like shell-shocked, you know? Finally, after 6 years of her serving in that German POW camp.
6 years, you know.
Years. Yeah, a German, and after her husband was like murdered, a German prisoner actually helped her escape. And she crosses the border into Austria, and then a truck comes and stops her, which had to have been like the scariest moment in her life.
Yeah.
And he was like, I will take care of you. I will take you to where all the Polish people are. And
I was telling her, I was telling my TV for her to run.
Oh, I'm
don't get in that truck, dummy.
No. But it was her future husband, Apollinary, who was driving. So that was like very sweet.
It was. And she also made a reference that people weren't nice. You know, like it was one of the few times where he was, you know, it just seemed too nice. That's why I was saying, run. But of course, I was 100% wrong.
And you and I are so used to these kinds of stories where if a van stops behind a woman walking, like, that's probably the right answer.
He's like, you need a ride? And it's like, no, you're on Unsolved Mysteries, run.
I know, exactly. Girl, you're in Austria, you're fine now. So Christopher's sister, Michelle Borrell, actually is the one telling her mom's story to Unsolved Mysteries. So Apollinary and Helena got married, stayed in Austria, and in October 1946, they adopt an infant named Christopher. Then they decide to move to a refugee camp in England. Mm-hmm. And little Michelle was their biological child. She was born in 1950. So they're going to do what a lot of people did back in the 1950s, and they're going to go to America, to the, you know, the promised land.
No.
And they are just waiting kind of on their visas to go through. Another Polish family who's in the refugee camp, they have their visas approved. So this is where it all gets very sketchy. Keep in mind, we're only told this through Michelle. And Michelle was like a year and a half, maybe 2 years old at the time. And she is telling us her mom's story. So we don't know how accurate it is.
And it's so sketchy. I mean, there are so many questions that I know that we have no way of knowing the answer to.
Exactly. No, it's really like, it seems like a lot of BS that you would tell a kid because you don't want them to know the ugly truth. Yeah. And it turns out that is kind of true. So then one of their family friends that are Polish in this refugee camp are like, ooh, we just got approved. We're going to America. Hey, let's take your 5-year-old Christopher with us because he can start school in America and he can get like the best education in the world.
And sounds great, but how do you just have another kid?
Right. Yeah. And how do you just let your kid go? I mean, these are hard questions. I don't mean to put that on anybody. Yeah. I'm sure it wasn't an easy decision. So they decide to let him go so he can start school in America. So they go, they're still waiting on their visas. They're like, we'll meet up with you soon because we're going to be going to America soon. So there's a bunch of rumors flying around about how dangerous America is. Some woman.
Oh my God. You can almost hear the jerk. We all know this woman who's like,
yeah,
you know what they do, right? You know, and it's like, and you're just like, you're so fearful now about it.
Yeah, she's like, you let your baby go there? So she's like, in California, babies get kidnapped by monkey. And it's like, wait,
and that
wait,
was the,
what?
That was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, so they're like, oh.
A ludicrous well, we don't story.
Want... Yeah, they're like, we don't want our babies to get kidnapped by a monkey. So they decide to withdraw their visa application. So allegedly, they write the family that took Christopher, the Bugajewskis, and they ask them to send Christopher back to England. And the other family is like, no, we're going to keep him.
Can you imagine the effort that would take? And the money?
Yeah, what are you going to do? Put him on a ship or something by himself, a 5-year-old? Like, it's crazy.
I mean, and he started school. He's in California, right? I mean, it's like the kid is in California in the early 50s, right?
Yeah, he's fine.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't make sense, like, to me. He's, like, learning about American culture. He's just settling in. I think it's so cruel for them to want to bring him back. I
to,
just
like,
really bothered
war
me.
War-ravaged England in a refugee camp.
Yeah.
So the other family's like, no, we're absolutely not going to send him back. So our family, Helena and Apollinary, they go to the Polish consul, and here's where it gets really sketchy. They can't prove that Christopher is theirs because Christopher's adoption records had gone with him to America. Now, why on earth would you do that unless you gave your child to somebody else?
Well, this is what I think happened. I think they signed the parental rights over.
Yeah, I think so.
They had to have.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, too. Because why? I mean, how else are they able to make all these decisions for him, put him in school, not send him back?
And let's be real here. I think that this was a little bit more. I think that this was our visa got approved and we said that we have 3 kids, but we have 2 kids. And for X amount of dollars, you can send your kid.
Interesting that you went that route. I didn't think that route. I was thinking, oh, we already have a biological kid. What do we want this adopted kid for anymore?
Right. So you give us your whole life savings until you come, you get them and all is great. Because it's probably easier to get a visa for less people than it is for more. So, I mean, if they're approved, they have the extra seat, why not? They just need to sign over the rights to the child.
Yeah, I think we got a very whitewashed version of this story through Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah.
Helen Apothecary, what's this? Sorry, Apollinary. And Michelle actually settled near Nottingham, England, and they continued to write to Christopher's family, never got a response. So in 1966, Michelle is 16, and she's like, I'm going to look for Christopher. So someone tells her to write the American Embassy and to put a letter inside for Christopher.
Now, in 66 in England, things are a lot better, you know.
Oh, groovy.
Yeah, groovy. but yeah, I mean, things over the past decade have... 13 years have improved greatly. So yeah, clearly they never went to the States. They decided to stay there, which I just think if you're so concerned about this kid, why didn't you go?
Yeah, it's, there's so much that we're not knowing here. And again, we're only told this is what they're telling Michelle her whole life growing up.
There's monkeys, so, Michelle, you don't want to go.
Exactly. That's what my husband said. Jack said, oh, that's a story that you tell kids so they don't play outside. You know, you're going to get stolen by a monkey.
Yeah.
So he writes back to her 2 months later. He says he was stationed in Vietnam. His new name is Stan Smith, but they never heard anything else. She said she checked with the postman like every day. Nothing ever happened. So Apollinaire dies. Michelle actually moves to America in 1973. And
even a better time. What a great time to come to America, actually, when I was born.
I know. It is like the most fun time. Probably.
It probably is, yeah.
Helena moved to America also with Michelle, but she died in April of 1992. And her dying wish was that her children are reunited.
Yeah.
So her wish came true. The children were reunited.
The end. And that's it.
The end.
The end. No picture. They show us some old pictures.
Yeah, they show us old pictures of, like, Christopher as a baby. But I did find a picture. Like I said, I'll put that on the Facebook page of them reunited, Michelle and Christopher. They were reunited in 1996 after his adopted sister saw an Unsolved Mysteries rerun. So Christopher's version is a little bit different.
Yeah.
He says that he was taken in by a family named Kurowski at about age 5 and that he ended up in an orphanage in England. From there, there was a mail order adoption where he was picked out of like a photo lineup of little kids and he was adopted by the Bogajewski family in Detroit. So it sounds like they actually just put him up for adoption. They didn't send him to America for better schooling,
but
he did end up in America.
Yeah, I read a little bit about they're called proxy adoptions and essentially it's like mail order adoption. And this would allow you to just literally see what kids are available by photograph. You know, the whole thing is so dark, you know?
Yeah, like, I hope you're cute enough, so somebody picks you out.
But, you know, the end result is a beautiful thing. I've said it before. I think it's one of the nicest things that somebody can do. It's just, I don't know, it's so cold. The process just seems a little bit cold. If I could just mention one thing about the monkeys, I do want to just mention, here on Long Island, in the 50s, even the late 40s, there was this area in a town called Massapequa. This is maybe a mile and a half from the Amityville Horror House. And there was this amusement park called, I think, the Massapequa Zoo. And this is something I'm going to look into. I do have photographs, but I remember my mother telling me about this. And there were stories about they had a huge, almost a sand silo-sized thing, and they would call it Monkey Mountain in the zoo. And it would just be covered in monkeys. And you would just go there, and from the distance, you could see this mountain of monkeys. And very often, these monkeys would escape.
Yeah.
And they would end up in people's backyards, attacking their dogs. Because this is, you know, this Massapequa Zoo is built in the suburbs of Long Island.
Yeah.
And there is a story that I need to look into it, but I do remember my mother telling me a story about a baby being attacked by a monkey and it being kind of worldwide news. Like, it was like a big deal. And as a matter of fact, it might have even been the reason why they shut down the mountain, you know, why they got rid of them all. And it's just a weird thing I just wanted to bring up. It kind of triggered this memory of mine. And I wonder if that is the story that kind of, you know, went overseas and they thought there's monkeys everywhere, but they were going on the other side of the country. They were going to California while this is in New York, but nonetheless,
crazy,
you know,
story.
It is, right? But,
yeah.
So anyway, it was owned by a guy who's, something Buck, and he was like the Indiana Jones of the time. You know, he was one of these kind of explorers. But anyway, I'll dig up some photos, and that has nothing to do with this Unsolved Mystery.
A little bit. No, it
maybe
totally does. But, you know, we end up with Michelle. She is alive and kicking. She lives in Texas. Christopher is alive and kicking. He lives in Eden, New York. From what I can tell, they don't really have too much contact with each other. They're not Facebook friends or anything like that. I found him on Facebook. But yeah, that's it. So,
but you did find the photo of the reunion. I thought it was just nice to see them together. I thought that was nice.
Yeah, and he looks just the same as he did when he was 5. He's so cute.
I hope they remain friends. You know, I hope
so too.
I mean, they're not related. Yeah, I mean, they're related through having a history of each other, but they're not blood related. So you have to wonder, like, if there was that kinship that would continue.
Yeah, I don't know. It seemed like she was all about finding him, yeah. And I'm sure there was quite the lore of him growing up in her household. And he, as far as he knows, was just given up at 5 years of age, you know, and I think that he had probably less of a connection, but that's just the story I'm putting on it. But yeah, no, we end with that nice, happy 1996 picture, and it'll be on Facebook for you guys to evaluate like we do.
Yeah, this has been, I think this is one of those episodes. It's kind of a smorgasbord of so many different times and things. We do tend to come back to this adoption story over and over again. I mean, the theme. And I don't know. I think that we'll continue seeing this pop up more and more throughout the other reviews of Unsolved Mysteries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Lost loves.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.